basically destroying the protections of the Israeli constitution for Israeli Jews and annexing the West Bank. And that's what this administration has been doing. That's what previous administrations have done. We finance this occupation. We finance this violence. There are American weapons that are being used today, right now, in Gaza, to kill innocent civilians in violation of U.S. law. And American politicians blithely talk as if they live on another planet. I think, though, that the ground has shifted. And even though American politicians live in Never Never Land, as far as Palestine is concerned, reality is going to intrude itself sooner or later. There is a widespread revulsion across the Arab world against what Israel does in Palestine. Authoritarian, dictatorial, absolute monarchies are trying to ignore that, ignore the feelings of their own people, the sentiments of their own people. That's not going to work. You cannot make peace over the bodies of Palestinians. That's not peace. That is the peace of the dead. And the kind of repression that is being exerted day in, day out, theft of land, expansion of settlements, and so on, necessarily, inevitably, is going to bring a reaction. So whether the people living in Washington, D.C., and in their own alternative reality, believe it today or tomorrow, sooner or later, I think that reality is going to dawn. You cannot do this forever.
The National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, just 10 days ago said, you know, it has been very quiet in the Middle East, which has allowed the U.S. to move on to other areas of the world. Very quiet, he said. And I'm wondering if you can comment on that. And do you think what led to this attack by Hamas fighters on Saturday had anything to do with Saudi Arabia and Israel normalizing relations at the behest of the United States?
I don't doubt that that was a factor. I think the basic factor was that people couldn't live under these circumstances. And Hamas has basically acted in a way involving enormous brutality against civilians, things that are unquestionably war crimes. But it has acted in a way to shatter that whole paradigm. I think people are thinking very carefully in places that have normalized with Israel. The other thing that should be said, I think Orly mentioned this, this is a massive intelligence failure on the part of American intelligence, and especially on the part of the Israeli intelligence services. They had absolutely no idea this was coming. They transferred 3 battalions from the Gaza front to the West Bank to protect several rampages against Palestinians, denuding the towns on the southern borders of the Gaza Strip of the people who could have defended against the attack by Hamas. This is one of the great deception operations in modern military history, and people are going to teach this. Leaving aside the war crimes, they're going to teach this in military academies for years and years to come. This is on level with the 1973 war in terms of deception and an entirely mistaken concept on the part of Israelis, thinking that you could do this to Gaza forever and that they would just lie down and take it.
And Rashid Khalidi.
Sorry.
This news just came out from Times of Israel, also from the Associated Press. Egyptian intelligence repeatedly told Israel Hamas was planning something big. Warnings were discounted. This, according to an intelligence official in Cairo. Your thoughts on this in the last 30 seconds?
It's very similar to what happened before the 1973 war, when Israel was getting intelligence that the Egyptian and Syrian armies were planning a major attack. And the conception, the conceptia in Hebrew, that these people would never do such a thing, they're not capable of this. The arrogance that was involved in ignoring those intelligence reports in 1973 and in 2023 are among the things that led to this catastrophic outcome, which I think is going to change a lot of things in the Middle East in the months and years to come.
Rashid Khalidi, I want to thank you for being with us. Edward Said, professor of modern Arab studies at Columbia University. His latest book, The 100 Years War on Palestine. Raji Sarani, Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, leading human rights lawyer, speaking to us from Gaza as the bombs went off. Ofer Kassif, member of the Israeli Knesset, and Orly Noy, board chair of B'Tselem, Israeli human rights organization. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, with echoes of the 1915 Armenian Genocide, a humanitarian crisis is unfolding in Artsakh after years of military aggression by Azerbaijan. Funded in part by the United States, ethnic Armenians have been forced to flee their homes. We'll also discuss a brewing controversy in Washington, D.C. A long-planned exhibition on Latino civil rights history has been canceled after right-wing politicians condemned its activist slant. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist. 2 weeks ago, the small mountainous Republic of Artsakh was vanquished by Azeri military forces. It happened with such haste that thousands of its predominantly ethnic Armenian population had just minutes to abandon their homes. This came on the heels of an Azerbaijani blockade that left Armenians without food, fuel, and medicine. Artsakh has been the site of a decades-long protracted battle between Muslim and Turkish Azerbaijanis and Christian Armenians. The conflict began when Armenia and Azerbaijan were under Soviet rule. After both nations gained independence, the conflict escalated into full-scale war. That war ended in 1994 with an independent Artsakh, the Armenian name for Nagorno-Karabakh, and Armenia in control of a wide swath of Azerbaijan. Unverified reports of mass killings and rape roused fears recently of a repeat of the 1915 Armenian genocide by the Ottoman Empire. The first genocide of the 20th century, it was the systematic destruction of the Armenian people and their identity during World War I. The genocide ended more than 2,000 years of Armenian civilization in eastern Anatolia, along with the mass murder of Assyrian, Syriac, and Greek Orthodox Christians, it enabled the creation of the Republic of Turkey. While the Turkish government denies the slaughter of Armenians with genocide, as of 2023, 34 countries have recognized the events as such. Joining us to talk about the recent forced expulsion of Armenians from Artsakh is Alex Galitsky, Programs Director at the Armenian National Committee of America. His opinions and analysis have been published in major media outlets, and he's worked at the local, state, and federal levels to advance policy and legislation to protect the rights of Armenian people around the globe. Alex, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
With everything that's been in the news in the past month or so, what is the current state of humanitarian conditions right now in Artsakh?
Well, as of today, we've received reports that about 70,000 Armenians from Artsakh have now fled into Armenia. And the expectation is that in the coming days and week, the remaining Armenian population in Artsakh would have been entirely evacuated as part of this mass exodus we've seen. I mean, the population has endured for the last 10 months a brutal blockade that deprived them of basic humanitarian goods, food, fuel, medicine, cut off their access to electricity, gas, water, and of course, the invasion by Azerbaijan starting on September 19th exacerbated those conditions and left the population with little choice but to leave. The thought that Armenians could ever live freely under Azerbaijan's rule following the behavior of Azerbaijan, not only over the course of the last 10 months, but going back years and decades, it would have been just unfathomable. This was a textbook case of ethnic cleansing. We've seen now columns of Armenian civilians fleeing along the road into Armenia, into the Armenian town of Goris, where there is currently humanitarian operations underway to document these people as they're coming in and try to connect them to relief services. The reality is, though, that the Armenian state is woefully unequipped to deal with the humanitarian crisis of this magnitude. As we're speaking, there are people still using this road to come in. People are waiting between 20 to 30 hours in traffic in the backlog to get from Artsakh to Armenia. We've heard of some tragic accounts of people dying along the way because this is a population that has still not received food, healthcare, medicine, and a basic goods that are still suffering from the consequences of that blockade. So the situation is extremely dire, and there is an urgent need for humanitarian assistance.
Speaking of that, Samantha Power, administrator of USAID, recently arrived in Armenia to affirm United States support for Armenia's sovereignty, independence, territorial integrity, and democracy. What role do you think the U.S. will play, if any, in the aftermath of the vanquishing of Artsakh?
Well, unfortunately, I think many of us in the Armenian-American community see the U.S. response here and Administrator Power's visit to Armenia as more a response to a U.S. credibility crisis than an Armenian humanitarian crisis. Unfortunately, this was a preventable crisis, one that the United States not only chose to ignore, but actually aided and abetted Azerbaijan along the way through sending it military assistance for many, many years and appeasing its dictatorship and legitimizing its use of starvation as a negotiating tactic over the last 10 months of this blockade. I mean, this was easily one of the most well-telegraphed genocides in history. Azerbaijan could not have made it clearer what its intent was. So I think from our perspective, this is far too little and far too late. We saw when Administrator Power was issuing a press conference in Goris, just miles away from where these tens of thousands of Armenian refugees have been entering, one Armenian in the crowd call out and say, sanction Azerbaijan or go back to your country. We don't want your lies. And I think that is really what adequately sums up the Armenian community's perspective on this now, is that the United States' gesture this last minute in response to a genocide that has already unfolded is simply inadequate. And the amount of assistance that the United States announced, $11.5 million, would barely be enough for, say, $95 per person coming in, which really can't be seen as anywhere near enough to support the needs of a population that is going to require medical treatment, psychological treatment, housing, resettlement, jobs, whatever it might be. The utter devastation of this crisis, it's almost an insult more than it is a humanitarian gesture. And I think while the United States expected to be welcomed with open arms, the reality is that people are just extremely disillusioned and they feel betrayed. They feel betrayed because Samantha Power, she came to prominence speaking out against the U.S. failure to respond to genocide, its failure to prevent genocide. She said we needed to be upstanders, not bystanders. And here we are, the U.S., a bystander of another mass atrocity crime. On top of that, just 4 days before Azerbaijan invaded Artsakh, there was a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing where a Assistant Secretary of State for European Eurasia, Yuri Kim, said very clearly, we will not tolerate a military attack by Azerbaijan on Nagorno-Karabakh, and we will not countenance any attempt at ethnic cleansing of the Armenian population of Nagorno-Karabakh. Here we are now, where both of these things have unfolded in very, very rapid succession, and the United States has not lived up to the pledge that it set during that hearing. So there is a real question about the credibility of the United States in responding to this catastrophe, and also beyond the South Caucasus, beyond this specific crisis, how the United States is able to show up for other persecuted and marginalized communities that have experienced this sort of aggression. So certainly while any form of humanitarian assistance coming in is welcomed. Of course, we've now heard from the spokesperson for the State Department that the U.S. is encouraging an international monitoring mission, although at this stage, I don't know what more they have to monitor other than the ethnic cleansing of our compatriots. They've also announced a direct action response, and they will send people to the ground to help coordinate the humanitarian response. Again, I think the sense is that this is far too little, far too late, and what we want to see is accountability. We want to see the United States really follow through on that commitment that it made during that hearing and in its rhetoric about putting human rights and democracy at the forefront of its foreign policy, and ensure that Azerbaijan doesn't get rewarded for this behavior, that Azerbaijan doesn't get away with this. And that should begin with immediately cutting all military assistance to Azerbaijan and also imposing sanctions on those responsible for this brazen act of ethnic cleansing.
Alex, I just want to clarify for our listeners, we're using both the term Artsakh and Nagorno-Karabakh, which is the same territory, but the Armenians call it Artsakh.
That's correct. That's correct.
And to your point, it's not just the United States that has failed to intervene. The international community as a whole has failed to prevent the atrocities that have been happening over the past three decades at least. Why is this?
Well, I think in large part, this is no coincidence. This is a deliberate and conscious decision that has been made to sacrifice Armenian lives for Azerbaijan's oil. Armenians have been rendered collateral damage in Europe and the U.S. and Russia and Turkey's geopolitical interests in the region. The Armenians and Artsakh have been seen as an inconvenience for the EU and for the U.S. It creates this awkward situation where they've had to deal with a regime in Azerbaijan that has been engaged in this persistent abuse of human rights and this continuous attempt at ethnic cleansing this population. And there was always a desire to be rid of this crisis. And I think that's what's happened right now. That's what we've seen unfold. So I really think this is that the nexus of where the values of the international community, human rights, democracy, self-determination, the things that we strive for and see as aspirational values, come into conflict with the cold, hard geopolitical interests that they seek to uphold. And that's where we found ourselves. Azerbaijan is an oil-producing state, and particularly now in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there's been this desire to diversify Europe's energy partners and find allies across the region that can meet Europe's energy needs. Azerbaijan has been groomed for this role for many years, going back to the early 2000s, where billions and billions of dollars were spent to develop its energy extraction and pipeline networks. And the United States also sees in Azerbaijan a partner in the containment of Russia and Iran. And that's why the U.S. has sent significant quantities of security assistance to Azerbaijan, which really escalated right before the invasion of Artsakh in 2020, where about $120 million of U.S. security assistance was sent to Azerbaijan. And that something like that cannot but help send a green light to the Azerbaijani regime that all of its abuses, both domestically and, of course, against the Armenian people, would be brushed to one side so long as they continue to cooperate with the U.S.'s interests in the region. And I think that's where we are right now. The United States had the opportunity, Europe had the opportunity to impose real costs on Azerbaijan for engaging in this consistent pattern of belligerency and aggression. There were many ways they could have done that. And I've mentioned two: sanctions or cutting security assistance or setting conditions for future oil purchases, perhaps, whatever they might be. They chose not to because they were afraid that Azerbaijan would retaliate by moving into the orbit of Russia or withdrawing its support for the West. So there was a calculated and conscious decision here. 120,000 Armenian lives sacrificed at the altar of regional geopolitical interests, Armenians as collateral damage in the U.S. and Europe's efforts to induce Azerbaijan's support for their broader geopolitical motives.
You know, when I was growing up, my grandparents escaped the genocide, and I remember a sense of shame. They never really talked about it, of course, and I just wonder if that kind of collective shame that a lot of people who survived the genocide and came to this country contributed to the fact that there really hasn't been much public awareness. And as you know, until recently, any acknowledgement that it was a genocide in this country. It's a shared history that I think is all the more tragic when we see it seems to be destined to repeat, as you say, for these geopolitical reasons. You mentioned the road that ethnic Armenians were fleeing Artsakh from. Is it called the Lachin Corridor?
That's right, the Lachin Corridor, which is the only humanitarian lifeline connecting Artsakh to Armenia.
Right. And in last year, 2022, it was for more than 250 days, Azerbaijan blocked that corridor.
That's right. It was the only means through which any humanitarian access was able to get into Artsakh. And Armenia, up until that point, was the only provider of any kind of humanitarian goods to Artsakh. There were 400 right. tons of goods coming in on a daily basis. After that blockade was imposed, nothing was getting in. And then after a certain point, when Azerbaijan consolidated that blockade, even international organizations like the International Committee of the Red Cross, the only international group that was able to provide any form of relief to the region, was blocked from accessing the region too, which meant that since about June, there was absolutely no humanitarian supplies coming into Artsakh.
Alex, if we could just take a few minutes to look back and give our listeners a brief history. How did Armenia come to be under Soviet rule? How did the conflict arise over this Republic of Artsakh? And how has the balance of power shifted over the years?
So this actually goes back to the point that you made, a very personal story for many Armenian Americans who are the descendants of survivors of the Armenian genocide. It was in the wake of the genocide that Armenia found itself captured by the Soviet Union. After the genocide, or after the First World War, rather, ended in 1918, the Turkish, or nascent Turkish Republic under the leadership of Kemal Mustafa Atatürk, was going on a campaign to try to reclaim territories that had been lost at the end of the First World War, and launched an assault on the then nascent First Republic of Armenia, which was founded by genocide survivors against unprecedented odds to try to carve out some semblance of sovereignty for an Armenia that hadn't been sovereign for hundreds of years. And the Armenians valiantly fought off the Turkish advances, but weakened through battle and genocide and starvation, the Soviets were able to take advantage of that and invaded Armenia and took control of what was there. I mean, at the same time, the Ottomans were, or the what was left of, the vestiges of the Ottoman Empire, were also supporting the establishment of the Azerbaijani state, the first time any political entity known as Azerbaijan has existed on a world map. And to do so, they engaged in massacres of Armenian populations in cities like Baku and Shushi, and in the region of Nakhchivan, which is today an exclave of Azerbaijan that is situated between Armenia and Turkey. And over the course of that process, we saw tens, if not 100,000 Armenians forced from across what is now Azerbaijan. The Russians came in and captured Azerbaijan as well in the wake of that conflict. And this is a very integral part of the history of the Armenian genocide. When the Soviets came in and captured Armenia and captured Artsakh and Azerbaijan, they recognized to some degree that the Armenians would never be able to live freely under Azerbaijan's rule, recognizing the history of genocide in the region. So they gave Artsakh some limited autonomy as a autonomous oblast. It had a degree of statehood below that of a Soviet republic, but some political, economic, and cultural autonomy. They placed this autonomous oblast of Nagorno-Karabakh under the administrative control of Azerbaijan in an attempt to appease not only the Azerbaijanis, but also Turkey. And this was all concocted by the then Commissar for Nationalities, Joseph Stalin. So by an arbitrary decision of the Soviet leadership, who ended up becoming one of the most brutal dictators in human history, the Armenians of Artsakh were placed under Azerbaijan's administrative control. And then for decades, for the 70 years of Soviet rule, these Armenians experienced the predictable acts of persecution you would see when you place the victims of genocide under the rule of their abusers. And for right. many decades, petitioned the Soviets and petitioned Moscow for their independence or their reunification with Armenia at the time. Those petitions were consistently rejected until we get to the late 1980s, when the policies of glasnost and perestroika allow for greater kind of freedom and protest in civil society spaces. And Armenians started to rise up. Across Armenia and Artsakh, millions of Armenians began protesting their mistreatment at the hands of Azerbaijan. And Azerbaijan retaliated by engaging in brutal pogroms against the Armenian communities in the towns of Sumgayit, Baku, and Kirovabad, which before the onset of the war in the 1990s had already displaced about 400,000 to 500,000 Armenian civilians. The Armenians, in response to these gruesome acts of ethnic cleansing taking place, declared their independence. They saw no choice but to take matters into their own hands and secede, and through a democratic referendum where 99% of the population of Artsakh voted for their independence, they formed the Republic of Artsakh. And Azerbaijan responded by launching an all-out war against the population that lasted for 4 long years. Mm-hmm. And the Armenians ultimately emerged victorious from that conflict and were able to secure some semblance of self-determination and autonomy moving forward. And it existed in that state for the 30 years until this point, where yesterday we tragically saw the leadership of Artsakh officially dissolve the Republic of Artsakh in response to Azerbaijan's demands and subjugation of the population by force.
And we should clarify that Artsakh was never officially granted statehood separate from Azerbaijan.
That's right. It was always considered a de facto entity,
right,
but subject to a long-term negotiation process that was overseen by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, which had designated this body known as the Minsk Group, which consisted of co-chairs Russia, France, and the United States, to oversee a solution that would respect the fundamental right to self-determination for the Armenian population, in addition to the principle of non-use of force. But unfortunately, that was a toothless body that was unable to ever truly enforce a mandate. And Azerbaijan consistently, over the course of the years that this body was in effect, undermined its authority, in fact, kicked the OSCE out of its country because they became too critical of Azerbaijan's domestic human rights record. And eventually that process collapsed entirely when Azerbaijan decided it would abandon the multilateral negotiation effort and seek to reclaim or capture this territory through military force. And that's what it began in 2020 and has consummated as of this past week.
I want to clarify, you had mentioned, I believe, that the U.S. has given military support to Azerbaijan. Have they recently bolstered their military forces?
The history of U.S. military support for Azerbaijan goes back to the early 1990s, where in the first Artsakh war, Congress passed a bill that actually prevented the U.S. from sending military assistance to Azerbaijan in light of its abuses against the Armenian population in Artsakh and its use of blockade against the civilian population of Artsakh. It was in the early 2000s, in response to the September 11 attacks and the U.S. military interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq, that a waiver authority was introduced that gave the president the ability to send military assistance to Azerbaijan whenever it was deemed to be in the national security interest of the U.S. That waiver was something that would have to be renewed annually, and every year from 2002 onwards, the president has waived those restrictions and provided military assistance to Azerbaijan. That continued right up until really this year. We're still in this kind of waiting period where we've been told by the State Department that the decision of whether or not to enforce those restrictions or waive those restrictions is under review. But at this point, it's very clear that by refusing to enforce those restrictions, the United States has sent a signal to Azerbaijan. What makes this all the more disappointing and tragic is in 2020, in the wake of or during the invasion of Artsakh back then, when we were in the middle of a 2020 election campaign, then-candidate Joe Biden criticized the Trump administration for sending assistance to Azerbaijan and vowed to enforce those restrictions when he was president. Not 6 months later, when he recognizes the Armenian genocide, we found out that on the congressional record, a day before he recognized the Armenian genocide, he reauthorized military assistance to Azerbaijan. So he recognized one genocide only to go on to enable another. So that assistance has continued right up until this day. We're in this waiting period right now, but it's very clear that in the absence of enforcement, Azerbaijan will think that it got away with it. And it doesn't end with Artsakh. Our concern as a community now is the security of Armenia, and especially southern Armenia, where Azerbaijan currently has military forces entrenched in sovereign Armenian territory.
I'm feeling very emotional hearing all of this, Alex. We have a few minutes remaining to dovetail with what you just said. Are Armenians seeking new allies to perhaps prevent what you've just described?
Well, I think at this point, Armenia has seen its traditional ally and security guarantor, which I think was one a relationship of necessity and dependence on Russia, has collapsed. Russia was unable to use its peacekeeping presence in Artsakh to prevent this from happening. In fact, a lot of what Azerbaijan did happened under the watch of Russian peacekeepers. Russia was unable to prevent Azerbaijan's assault on Armenian sovereign territory in September of last year. But at the same time, the United States, despite all of its assurances to hold Azerbaijan, to prevent ethnic cleansing and to warn Azerbaijan against the use of military force, has not been able to do anything to actually compel behavioral change in Azerbaijan. The U.S.'s promises really ring hollow right now. So I think while Armenians are in desperate need of new security guarantors, the reality is that no one has been willing to step up to do that. And that has left Armenia in an incredibly vulnerable position right now, especially as Azerbaijan and Turkey's leaders met last week and started to renew this conversation about establishing a corridor through southern Armenia to connect Azerbaijan directly with Turkey. This is a big concern right now. We've seen Azerbaijan and now Turkey's leaders make very blatant territorial claims over the sovereign Republic of Armenia. And while many people are now saying that they couldn't have seen Azerbaijan's invasion of Artsakh coming, which I think is willful ignorance, for anyone to assume that Azerbaijan is not capable of or willing to engage in further acts of military aggression against Armenia to get its way, they would be fooling themselves. And this is a time where the international community needs to be extremely vigilant.
Alex, can you just tell our listeners what is the Armenian National Committee of America doing in terms of pushing for legislative policy changes, emergency actions? What should our listeners be made aware of? What can possibly remediate this horrible situation?
Well, there are a couple of things that we're focusing on right now. First is the United States has to play a role in ensuring that all of those Armenians that seek to leave Artsakh are able to do so safely. Unfortunately, as we saw yesterday, the former state minister of Artsakh, Ruben Vartanyan, who is a very well-known philanthropist and someone who's dedicated his life to supporting efforts, humanitarian efforts around the world, was illegally detained by Azerbaijan when he was trying to flee Artsakh into Armenia. And his fate is now uncertain. We've also heard that the former foreign minister of Artsakh, David Babayan, has said that he will comply with Azerbaijan's illegal orders to turn himself in to ensure the safety of his people. We know Azerbaijan has identified a couple of hundred names of individuals that they want surrendered, and that is something that we're extremely concerned about. So we continue to push that the United States should ensure the safe exit and evacuation of all Armenians, and that amnesty should be granted for all those who seek to flee, that Azerbaijan must immediately release prisoners of war and people that they've detained both during this recent conflict and the one in 2020. But outside of that, the two tangible legislative priorities we have are to ensure that humanitarian assistance, and significantly more humanitarian assistance than has been already allocated, the 11.5 million I mentioned earlier, is sent to support the needs of the population that has been displaced, to ensure their resettlement, to ensure food security, all these things that we know the Armenian state is woefully unequipped to handle. But then the other, I think, very important component of this, in addition to the humanitarian relief effort, which we also believe has to be done in a coordinated and international way, is that the United States must demonstrate to Azerbaijan that it won't be rewarded for its behavior. There must be consequences for this brazen act of ethnic cleansing. There must be consequences for Azerbaijan breaching what the United States set as its own red line when it came to Azerbaijan's behavior, the use of force and the comments about not willing to countenance any attempt at ethnic cleansing. So we are currently working with lawmakers in the House and Senate. There are two bills right now that would call for a permanent end to all U.S. military assistance to Azerbaijan, and then the imposition of sanctions on Azerbaijani officials involved and complicit in the perpetration of human rights abuses. We want to find mechanisms to which Azerbaijan will be held accountable, where human rights abuses will be investigated, and where Azerbaijan will face real repercussions for its behavior. So those are the things that we're currently focusing on. And one indication of the groundswell of political support we've seen was that just recently a letter was sent to Secretary Blinken signed by 96 legislators calling for the imposition of sanctions. And I expect that in the coming days and weeks, as the true scale and magnitude of this humanitarian disaster reveals itself, the calls for the Biden administration to act decisively to hold Azerbaijan accountable will only grow more and more stronger.
Alex, what is your social media account or a way that our listeners can follow these efforts and hopefully get involved?
Listeners can visit at ANCA_DC on Twitter and other social media sites to follow the work that we're doing. They can also visit the ANCA's website and subscribe as a rapid responder at anca.org/alert in order to take action, to contact their legislators, to send emails, text messages, social media posts that bring attention to what's happening and ensure that their members of Congress are taking action on all fronts to ensure Azerbaijan is held accountable and the victims of Azerbaijan's genocide of Artsakh receive the humanitarian relief that they desperately need.
Yes, and we have to stop this, which is really a protracted continuation of the genocidal tendencies dating back to the Ottoman Turks. Alex, thank you so much for your important work. We support you. We'll have you back on in a few months, hopefully with some better news. Thank you for fighting this important fight.
Thank you, Heidi, for shedding a light on this incredibly important and often overlooked story.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. In 2020, Congress appropriated funding to create a National Museum of the American Latino. Last year, the Smithsonian Institution opened a temporary preview exhibition inside the National Museum of American History. The show was slated to be the largest federally funded Smithsonian exhibit on Latino civil rights history. The nation's top Latino historians and veterans of the movement gave input. It was to feature student walkouts, school integration initiatives, and environmental and immigration activism. But instead, it has become the focus of controversy within the Latino community over how Latinos in the U.S. should be portrayed. The Smithsonian, in response, has nixed the show. In its place will be an exhibit on salsa and Latin music. That's because Republican lawmakers and others have challenged what one conservative writer described last year in The Hill as a, quote, unabashedly Marxist portrayal of history. Right-wing Latino political activists and Cuban-American politicians have voted to defund the museum. This controversy comes as the Smithsonian is trying to raise funds to build a museum at an estimated $800 million. Of this, $58 million has been raised to date. Two historians were hired to develop the exhibit on the Latino civil rights movement of the 60s. One of them joins us today. Felipe Hinojosa is a history professor at Baylor University in Texas. He's also the author of Apostles of Change, Latino Radical Politics, Church Operations, and the Fight to Save the Barrio. Felipe, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
If you can give our listeners a nutshell explanation of the current temporary preview exhibition, Presente, which opened in June 2022, and a few of the points that it strives to make.
Sure. I think one of the important aspects of this exhibit is that it really brings together the complicated and nuanced and diverse experiences of Latinos in the United States that, of course, are descendants from all kinds of places in Latin America and the Caribbean. It's an exhibit that begins with the colonial legacies. I mean, there are, if we sort of think about the history of Latinos in the United States, it's diverse in terms of food, in terms of language, culture, certainly different forms of the way people speak Spanish, indigenous languages, and so forth. But there is a shared history of colonialism. And so the exhibit begins with those colonial legacies and how indigenous people remade their lives. And then it moves on to the wars of expansion. In 1848, the U.S. Invaded Mexico, or in 1846, I'm sorry, invaded Mexico, and 2 years later purchased the land. It went from parts of Texas all the way out to the Pacific coast. 50 years later, in 1898, another war of expansion that went to the Caribbean, the Spanish-American War, essentially took over the Spanish colonies of Cuba, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, and Guam. The exhibit moves on then from there to Texas and looking at the relationship that Texas had and westward migration from Euro-Americans that were looking to expand slavery westward and also for land and work opportunities as well. As it moves into the 20th century, the exhibit covers immigration, and that's another big theme in Latino history and a shared aspect. And so it covers the history of labor recruiters that would go to the borderlands region, agricultural recruiters, people from factories across the Midwest and so forth, that were recruiting laborers from Mexico. And of course, in the early part of the 20th century, there's a push-pull factor in Mexico with the Mexican Revolution that is pushing people out. And at the same time, World War I is creating a vacuum in terms of the labor shortages across the Southwest and in different places. So Mexican immigrants are filling that. The exhibit then moves on to the building of community throughout much of the 20th century. Once these immigrants are here, they have families. They are engaging in American culture and American traditions and television and pop culture and music and dancing. So the exhibit gets into those parts and really begins to wrap up around the time that Latinos begin to organize for civil rights and for their place in American democracy. So it does a lot, and I really give a lot of credit to a lot of the curators that were involved there because they made it come to life, and they told a very complicated story. I think they told it in a way that museum goers would understand and be able to appreciate.
And you've been consulting on this project for how long?
The project that I was consulting was the exhibit that would have come after the Presente, the current exhibit there. So when I joined the Smithsonian team was in 2021. Presente, I believe, had already opened or was about to open right after the pandemic and everything that was going on there. And so I worked on a civil rights exhibit that would have come right after Presente. But I walked through it. I got chills going through it. There's nothing like seeing yourself reflected in an exhibit like that at such a prestigious place as the Smithsonian.
Yes, I can imagine. Now, let's clarify. The conservative Latino faction who have criticized this, are they criticizing the preview exhibition, Presente, and also the exhibition to come?
Yes. Well, it started with Presente. That was the first attack that came in the form of an article that was written in The Hill, the online journal among Washington insiders and folks that follow U.S. politics. And that article emerged, I think it was published in the summer of 2022. It essentially criticized Presente. There wasn't any mention of the civil rights exhibit that was to come, I think primarily because the authors didn't necessarily have a clue of what was coming next after Presente. Presente right. would have stayed live until 2025. And so their critiques were on the exhibit. They claimed it was Marxist. They claimed it was liberal. They claimed that it didn't tell the story of, quote, what America has done for us. You know, and I found that very, very interesting, sort of considering especially the famous words of John F. Kennedy. He asks not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And I think Presente was speaking more to the question that Kennedy was prompting all of us to ask. It's, what can we do for the nation? And it's interesting that they were sort of flipping that and wanting to sort of get in a narrative that speaks to this somehow savior of a nation that is doing things for us rather than us participating in its democracy.
Now, talk a bit about the reaction by the Smithsonian administrators and what they said to you in light of this criticism.
So we had been working, I think, almost 2 years when this article in The Hill came out in the summer of 22. As soon as that article dropped, I think there was concern that there would be restrictions or that our exhibit would somehow be censored. That, of course, came to be in November of 22, maybe 3 or 4 months after that first article criticizing Presente came out. Leaders of the National Museum of the American Latino, Jorge Samaniego as its founding director, came to us and essentially told us that they were putting our exhibit on pause, is the language that they used initially, although I would argue it was a cancellation. And the only reasons that they gave us for this had everything to do with the fact that our exhibit simply didn't have broad enough appeal. I have come to learn since then that broad appeal means dollars. It means fundraising dollars. This is not about what our community or people in the U.S. of all backgrounds would want from the Smithsonian, but a way to sort of think about fundraising efforts and perhaps an exhibition on salsa music and dancing, which is what replaced our exhibit, you know, would do better at raising money than a political exhibit. And I think it went to that stereotype of they like Latinos dancing and entertaining. They don't want us involved in politics.
Now, let's talk a bit about what the exhibit was going to highlight. I understand that some of the history included the first Patients' Bill of Rights that the Young Lords drafted, the 1968 walkouts in which 20,000 Latino students protested discrimination in schools, and a lawsuit by 5 Latino families that really predated the landmark U.S. Supreme Court school desegregation case of Brown v. Board of Education. Why are these controversial?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know why these would be so controversial if they are at the centerpiece of institutions. You look at educational access, Latinos fighting for educational access, an end to public school segregation in Texas and in California, as you mentioned, the Mendez versus Westminster case that laid the groundwork for Brown v. Board of Education. And then young people themselves taking it upon themselves to walk out of schools in protest of a racist curriculum and in favor of hiring more Mexican-American teachers, people that reflected their cultural values and so forth. And so all of those things, and we look at the Young Lords in New York City and drafting a Patient Bill of Rights and working to build a better public healthcare infrastructure in this nation, all of those things are at the centerpiece of our history as Americans, the ways in which young people, in particular young people, have engaged the nation and compelled it to live up to its founding principles of equality and justice for all. I've taught in colleges and universities now for 20 years, and so for my students, this is not controversial. For my students, and I have students of all backgrounds, for my students, it's empowering. It gets them thinking about their own social and personal responsibility to democratic movements today. So I'm also confused in terms of why that would seem to be controversial. But again, I think they would rather see Latinos peddling a kind of assimilationist narrative and being grateful and thankful to the nation rather than a narrative that looks at struggle, that looks at community building, and one that is nuanced and complex.
Exactly. And when we speak about the Young Lords and a lot of these other really courageous, groundbreaking individuals over the years, They were protesting. They were, you know, rabble-rousing. That's uncomfortable when it happens. But the end result really transforms society. It seems as though these conservative legislators and pundits would, as you suggested, rather see the Latino community being equated with salsa and not with protesting the status quo.
That's absolutely accurate. And I think we often do not give young people in the 60s and 70s, especially Latinos, who in the 60s and 70s themselves were an invisible minority. Most folks were engaged or understood, or people that were that cared about civil rights were rightfully so engaged in the Black freedom struggle. The story of Latinos and their coalitions with Black Americans, the ways in which they joined Asian American freedom struggles and Native American freedom struggles, that narrative and that story is one that most Americans do not know. It remains on the margin. And that, I think, is convenient for these conservative politicians and conservative pundits who continue to peddle this idea also of us as, you know, perpetually foreign, new immigrants. We haven't contributed anything to the nation. We're here only to take jobs. We're not here to create jobs. That's a narrative that fits neatly into their constituency and their political aspirations, but it's not history. It's not American history. American history is about struggle. It's about community. And it's, again, about working for justice and equality for all communities.
Well, speaking of history, in your capacity as a professor of history in the state of Texas, have you experienced criticism for your course curricula?
Not me specifically. I, as a historian, I certainly engage critical race theory and other theories that have been the sort of hot button issues out there. But I think academic freedom has kept the door open for us, thankfully, to continue to do the work that we've wanted to do. But I was at Texas A&M University for 14 years, and you might have followed what was happening at Texas A&M just a few months ago in terms of the state legislature in Texas wanting to kill diversity, equity, and inclusion offices, or what they call DEI efforts and offices. I was serving as assistant provost for Hispanic-serving institutions initiatives there at Texas A&M, and we were told very, very bluntly and very directly that we could not do anything that promoted the work of being a Hispanic-serving institution at Texas A&M until the state legislature decided or moved on a decision for what it was going to do with DEI efforts across the state. Of course, those offices, the votes passed, the DEI efforts were killed in Texas, and our office shut down. The Office for Diversity at Texas A&M University shut down. And I think it's a complete tragedy to start in an office in August, as I did in the fall semester of 2022, with a thriving office, with staff, beautiful artwork on the walls, and then to get there in June of 2023 to see it full of boxes as people were beginning to move out. The work of diversity had ended at that particular university.
What do you see as the problem with categorizing history as either liberal or conservative?
That's a great question. I think it has a lot to do with packaging history and keeping it within these tight silos, right? Where, you know, there's no room for negotiation. There's no room for nuance. There's no room to, you know, move around. And we have either a you know, liberal or conservative perspective on history that I think gets in the way of understanding just how complicated we are as human beings and just how complicated our communities are. One of the things that I love about the work of the Puerto Rican Young Lords in New York City and in Chicago and other Latino radicals in the 60s and 70s was their capacity to negotiate, their capacity to negotiate with reformers, with people that they would have fundamentally disagreed with about how to move forward social justice movements. When we think about history as liberal or conservative, we really hurt ourselves. We hurt our students rather than leaving it open to discussion, to explore what the evidence says, to look at primary documents, to listen to what oral histories can tell us about a particular era in American history. That's the beauty of history. And I think students get it. Students completely understand it. They know when, you know, you're trying to sell them a neatly packaged story here. We all live complicated lives. And so to go into a history class and to see it play out in the way that it does, that's when I see the transformation in my students' eyes and in their hearts, where they begin to raise important questions. And what really begins to happen, and I think this is why history is so powerful, is that students begin then to internalize this. They begin to say, where do I fit? Where does my family fit in the American story? And students of all backgrounds do that. I teach Latinx history classes, and I have white, Black, Asian, Native American students, Latino students that are in there. And every time I see it happen in really, really significant ways where students are understanding what's happening in the world and then bringing it home, asking then their grandparents, where does our story begin? Tell me about what it was like to live in during the Great Depression. That's important work. We all need to be doing that work.
So important. And when you were mentioning the skills of the young lords in negotiating and talking to people with different viewpoints, what an important lesson for this moment in history when our two major political parties cannot talk.
Exactly. And I think it tells us something about the power of young people and youth movements that I really took issue when Jorge Samaniego said that somehow our movement, our exhibits and our movements don't have broad appeal. Nothing could be further than the truth. We could learn a lot from studying the young lords.
Felipe, could you give a couple of examples of stories that you had hoped to include in the exhibition, the 2025 exhibition, that our listeners might not have heard about?
Yes. Well, in addition to what you mentioned, the walkouts in East Los Angeles and even in South Texas that were going to be included, we were going to highlight the occupation of churches by the young lords in Chicago and in New York City. I think most Americans would not know that story of how young lords, together with seminarians and together with clergy people, Christian folk, that they worked to build churches or transform their sacred spaces into spaces of service, where they could have a breakfast program for kids, where they had a clothing drive for the community, where people could come together and sing and share poetry and have an open space to do these sorts of things. Churches hold very, very powerful places in our country, and the ways in which the young lords transformed them into people's spaces, into what they called the people's church. We were going to build a beautiful exhibit around the steeple and the doors of the church, and how young people in the 60s and 70s, contrary to what we often think in terms of them being anti-religion or anti-church, how they actually worked with clergy to help serve their community. The other big thing that I want to highlight that our movement, that our exhibit was going to do, was link not only Chicano and Chicana or Mexican-American movements in the Southwest with Puerto Rican movements in the Northeast, but also contemporary immigrant rights movements, and in particular, looking at how environmental disasters today are fueling a lot of social movements that young people are taking to social media. And in particular, we were going to highlight the aftermath and the work that's been done after Hurricane Maria devastated the island of Puerto Rico. And so that to think about all of those things together in one space, young people today who are going to school with diverse student bodies, they want to know how they can build coalitions. Young folk want to know how they can form coalitions with other people to get them thinking about immigrant rights, to make sure that people have enough food or access to food and public health. All of these things are questions that young people have, and history offers them an opportunity to learn from what's been done in the past. And we were going to highlight all of those things. It's heartbreaking to think that's not going to happen anymore.
Is the 2025 exhibition that I believe was going to be in the Molina Gallery, is that definitely next?
Yes, it is. That's the one that now is replaced by an exhibition on salsa music.
Oh, that is. Okay. I thought that was just a temporary one. Oh, dear.
The idea is there is some conversation about our exhibit perhaps being placed in the National Museum of American History, but those are still in that's still a conversation.
And can you briefly explain, this is just was slated for the Smithsonian?
That's correct.
Is this something, I'm just curious, that you talk about with your students? Are they aware of what's been happening?
Oh, absolutely. This is a beautiful teaching moment, right? This is something that we need to all be talking about. I think it raises important questions about public history, about the ways in which young people can take what they learn at the university level and take it to their communities. I assign a lot of projects where students will go and interview their grandparents or their parents. And all of this, I think, bears into, you know, this question of our participation in this country and in helping to make this country what it is. And yes, yeah, we are having these conversations with our students and they are listening. This generation, I think, is very much in tune with wanting to participate in one way or another, and we should be listening to them as well.
Felipe, how can our listeners follow your work, and also how can they learn more or get involved in this specific case?
That's an ongoing discussion, and I think it's really critical for a number of things. If you're involved, if people out there listening are involved in local community organizations or local museum boards or working in any way with community organizations, I think either starting a petition or contacting the Smithsonian directly, the Secretary of the Smithsonian, Lonnie Bunch, contacting him directly and saying, this is something that we want to see and that we believe has broad appeal. I think that would be really important. And continue to have discussions about Latino history. I think we are right now in the middle of Hispanic Heritage Month. Most of the time, there's beautiful celebrations around mariachi music and food and all of that. But there's also, I think, a political discussion to be had, and it's so necessary given everything that is currently going on in the border and so forth. So I'm hoping people will engage in different ways that they can, pick up a book on Latino history and learn from it, be involved in your local community organizations, and do what you can to tell this broader national story.
I'd also like to make a plug for your book, which I haven't read yet, but I'm going to order, Apostles of Change, Latino Radical Politics, Church Occupations, and the Fight to Save the Barrio. Well, thank you so much for your important work, Felipe. And we will follow this story. We've had Johanna Fernandez on in the past. She's a friend of the show, so we're really rooting for you and hoping that your well-planned, hard-fought-for exhibition will find a new home, if not back at the Smithsonian. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. You can get the show on there. You can ask questions. You can email us. We want to hear from you.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards. WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
You talked about Mohamed Bazoum of Niger. Mohamed Bazoum comes from a socialist party, but they have not been socialists for decades. They are basically caretakers for the United States, the French, and so on. US has the largest drone base in the world in Agadez, Niger. These guys have become caretakers for the imperialist bloc.
That's Vijay Prashad, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vijay Prashad on Africa, from neoliberalism to independence. Almost every country in Africa was colonized by Europe. Today, while nominally sovereign, many of these countries are in the clutches of the big international banks. The old colonial masters, Britain and France, still have a foothold in Africa, but the U.S. has been pushing them aside, moving in to capture resources and markets. Washington has established an Africa command, deployed troops, and built a string of bases. But France won't let go of its grip on its former colonies. The coup in Niger, a former French colony, is not your run-of-the-mill coup. It must be understood in the context of widespread discontent with ruling elites and their collaboration with imperialism. Genuine independence is still far off for Niger and other countries in the Sahel region of West and Central Africa. To talk about these issues is Vijay Prashad. He's an internationally renowned historian and journalist. He's the director of Tricontinental and chief correspondent for Globetrotter. He's the author of many books, including Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations. I interviewed Vijay Prashad in mid-August. He was at his home in Santiago, Chile. Welcome back to the program.
So, salam alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. There are coups and there are coups. The one in Niger, ousting the elected government of Mohamed Bazoum on July 26, you say is different. How so? You make a distinction then between generals' coups and colonels' coups. Explain what you mean.
Well, look, we know that coups have a certain patina, a certain understanding in the consciousness. For instance, if you go back in the history of the modern world since 1945, there have been a series of important coup d'etats. Let's take a part of the world I know very well. Take Pakistan. Pakistan wins its independence in 1947. You know, it's a decent liberal government, Liaquat Ali Khan leading the government. When the left started to make its noises, and that too not in a very loud way, the military entered. There was a coup d'etat almost immediately. Now, Pakistan punctually seen generals' coups. Not only are these coups led by generals, you know, General Ayub Khan, General Yahya Khan, General Zia-ul-Haq, General Parvez Musharraf. It's not only that they are generals, but in a sense, they also represent the oligarchy of the country. They do a coup against the possibility of the diminishment of power